Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
If you watch any movie from Hollywood's golden age today, you'll notice something distinctive about the way many actors speak.
Oh, we're going to talk about me, are we? Goody.
Katharine Hepburn in Philadelphia Story. Orson Welles in Citizen Kane.
You're right, Mr. Thatcher. I did lose $1 million last year. I expect to lose $1 million this year. I expect to lose $1 million next year. You know, Mr. Thatcher, at the rate of $1 million a year, I'll have to close this place in 60 years.
Or Betty Davis as Margot Channing in All About Eve.
Nice speech, Eve. But I wouldn't worry too much about your heart. You can always put that award where your heart ought to be.
I've always been fascinated by this old-timey accent, whether in black and white movies or in the TV commercials of my youth.
You see, High Point has a special way of capturing flavor, deep-brewed flavor.
You see, High Point has a special way of capturing flavor.
Better, yes. Deep-brewed flavor.
Deep-brewed flavor.
Nice.
Who knew Lauren Bacall was such a coffee connoisseur? But just where did this peculiar accent come from?
It was a real accent. It was a really dominant sound in the northeastern part of America.
And one that commanded authority.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The idea that that's the way you wanted to hear your leaders speaking is a different kind of America than today.
So why does almost nobody talk like this anymore, with the exception of Kelsey Grammer?
Rather than truckle to the forces of commercialism, I've decided to take a stand on principle.
It's a mystery I'm determined to solve. From CBS Sunday Morning and iHeart, I'm Mo Rocca, and this is Mobituaries. This Mobit, the death of an accent.
Now, this is where it gets a little bit controversial. There's a lot of disagreement around what to call this, because it's been commonly called the Mid-Atlantic accent.
I call it the old Arliss dialect, or that way they talked in old movies. It's Betty Davis, roughly.
That's linguist and New York Times columnist John McWhorter. You may remember John from our episode on the death of once popular names. He's helping me today with some of this dialect detective work. Let's listen to Betty Davis herself. Pay attention to the way she says Parker.
It was written by that outstanding leading lady of literature, Dorothy Parker. Dorothy Parker is the one who said, men seldom make passes at girls who wear glasses.
Parker instead of Parker. Yeah, that accent.
And is that the primary characteristic when we're discussing this way of talking, R-lessness?
Yeah. What sticks out today is that R's at the end of syllables have a way of softening or even not being present. And there's a certain archness that we detect. We imagine that the women had fluty voices, et cetera. But then again, Betty Davis did not have a fluty voice. She didn't talk like this. She had a rather low cigarette-stained voice. And yet, what we hear in her is Parker instead of Parker, corner instead of corner. And that's where you get this accent that's sounding ever more exotic as the decades go by.
Sounds almost alien. And it makes people, I think, today, especially young people, kind of laugh.
I think that's absolutely true. It makes a lot of older movies difficult for people, I would say at this point, under 50, to take, because everybody seems to talk funny. It's been a long time since any real person spoke that way.
Where does the R-listus come from?
There are some consonants that are less hardy than others. Like R is a very muddy kind of sound. It's almost like a vowel. There's a difference between going P or T and going R. It's muddy. When you hang an R on the end of a vowel, it's delicate. It's kind of like hair and split ends. You know that that R is ripe for getting soft. It's going to change the color of the vowel before it. And pretty soon the R is going to probably disappear.
It's going to erode.
It's going to erode, as we put it. And so in any English, any R's that are at the end of syllables, such as in Parker, are in danger in a way. And it's almost a matter of not whether, but when stuff is going to start to happen.
Would you find this all over the United States?
Well, actually, no. It's interesting. You have it most prominently in New York and thereabouts. And then also you have it in Boston. And then it also happened in the South. But that was also partly because African languages on the West Coast tend not to have R's at the end of syllables. Slaves were brought to the Southern United States, often helped bring up kids. That meant that the R's were certainly going to fall away in the South.
They were dropping their R's.
So it's a different reason. So that's why you have the R-less Southern accent. And so that means Black English is R-less all over the country. But the main things that people tend to think about, if we're talking about, say, Betty Davis, is what was going on in the northeastern United States starting in the 1800s.
And she was from Lowell, Massachusetts.
She was from Lowell.
Well, let's listen to her right now in All About Eve.
Eve, this is an old friend of Mr. DeWitt's mother, Miss Caswell, Miss Harrington.
Miss Caswell, how do you do?
Addison, I've been wanting you to meet Eve for the longest time.
It could only have been your natural timidity that kept you from mentioning it.
You've heard of her great interest in the theater.
Love that clip.
And it's where she's meeting Marilyn Monroe, right?
And Marilyn Monroe walks in and she's the most beautiful thing in the world.
She's luminous.
She glows.
Yeah, she really does. She glows. Okay, now let's listen. Oh, and I just have one other thing to say about All About Eve. I remember my father once said to me, he said, the two most purely evil characters sort of in Western arts and culture and the Western canon were Iago in Othello and Eve Harrington in All About Eve.
Not Addison DeWitt, but Eve. Yes, she is more evil. That's definitely true. She has no feelings. That is absolutely the case. I want to be Addison.
Right. You're referring to Addison DeWitt, the imperious drama critic.
I wish Sondheim were still alive so that he would do a musical of All About Eve that actually is All About Eve, as opposed to Applause 50 years ago, which wasn't. And because I'm kind of the age and the temperament, and we're now so interested in diversity in the theater, I want to play Addison, but I can tell nobody is going to do it.
You would be great.
That I should want you at all suddenly strikes me as the height of improbability. But that in itself is probably the reason.
Did people speak like this in all cities on the Eastern Seaboard?
No, they didn't. This R-lessness developed by chance in some places and not others. New York and Boston have it, but Philadelphia and Baltimore don't. And particularly,
they kept their R's.
Philadelphia and Baltimore were R-full, were rhotic cities, as we call it.
It just skipped those cities. So it's ironic then that Katharine Hepburn's big comeback, early comeback, was playing Tracy Lord in The Philadelphia Story.
You seem quite contemptuous of me all of a sudden.
She wouldn't have sounded that way.
In other words, Tracy Lord would not have ordered a cheesesteak. She would have ordered one. Other aspects of this accent, it's posh, it's proper. What would you say? How would you describe it?
That is an accent that sounds British to us. And I think there's an idea that everybody was trying to sound British. I question that. I think that the way American English happened to develop was something that would have happened whether there was a Great Britain and whether we associated it with poshness or not.
Here's a surprise. John McWhorter says early Americans didn't talk this way.
We have a tendency to think that the founding fathers, for example, because they were such formal and educated people, we assume that they sounded like Masterpiece Theater, or if that's a dated reference, like many of the actors in Harry Potter. And actually, that's not true. That accent actually developed after America was already up and running.
So Thomas Jefferson would have said when in the course of human events.
Definitely.
And John says the Brits themselves only started dropping their R's in the late 1700s.
So in the early 1600s, it was William Shakespeare.
Definitely. Yeah. There was no R-lessness among the people in the Globe Theater. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And it was the Virgin Queen.
The Virgin Queen, not the Virgin Queen. Right.
Although when Betty Davis played her, she was the Virgin Queen.
Then all of a sudden, she's the Virgin Queen.
Yes. I'm suddenly imagining Betty Davis walking into the Hundred Acre Wood and having to greet that donkey. Eeyaw. This accent, with its emphasis on enunciation, was especially prevalent in the early American theater. Before the invention of the microphone, it tended to carry all the way to the back of the house.
And then once amplification comes in, old habits die hard, and so you have these people, you know, on the soundtracks of these old movies still talking in a way that maybe would have been thought of as a better way to sound if you're doing Our American Cousin in 1865, as opposed to what you need to do now.
Thank you for the Our American Cousin reference, which, of course, was the stage comedy that Lincoln was watching at Ford's Theater. You know, I've always wondered, there was a star of it, but then there was a guy who was the second banana who played kind of the funny guy role. And there's an insult he lays on her. And that's the big laugh line. And that's when John Wilkes Booth fired the gun. He was waiting for a laugh line. You suck dologizing old man trap.
Uh-huh,
and that was the big, that was sort of like the sit on it Potsy of its time.
So few people are going to get that.
All right. That's what she said of its time.
Right.
Wait, what are the people laughing to now? I don't know what they're laughing to now.
Now, it wasn't only Hollywood royalty who spoke like this, but also the political elite. Here is Teddy Roosevelt campaigning to return to the White House in 1912.
These prohibitions have been turned by the courts from safeguards against political and social privilege into barriers against political and social justice and advancement. Our purpose is not to impugn the courts, but to emancipate them from a position where they stand in the way of social justice.
That was amazing. I've never heard him. There's a story of him going up to Albany when he is in the assembly. And he was made fun of for the way he talked because that Arliss accent sounded silly to a lot of the people from other parts of the state. They imitated him as saying, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, when he wanted to talk. That's not the way people from further upstate spoke.
Okay, let's hear now his fifth cousin, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
It's perfect.
Okay, this is 21 years after that clip we heard from Teddy, but it's still there, that accent.
Mm-hmm. Very much in the 30s.
Like so many millions of others, my Italian grandmother, she, to her dying day, was grateful to him for the New Deal, for the WPA. And, you know, she didn't talk anything like that.
The idea that that's the way you wanted to hear your leaders speaking is a different kind of America than today.
You know, it's funny. My grandmother might have not only expected it, but demanded it.
That's right.
That her leaders speak like that.
John McWhorter says that in politics, that accent is as much of a relic as the art of oratory itself.
Your grandmother would not have tolerated the way a lot of our leaders today speak in public. And it's not to say that there isn't a such thing as being very eloquent within the bounds of being colloquial and casual. But for someone to get up and talk the way Trump does, and this is independently of the content, but just that kind of scattershot half sentences and, you know, rarely completing a thought, that would have been processed as amateurish, as offensive.
But it's interesting the transition that happens because, you know, FDR's last vice president and his successor, of course, is Harry Truman, who does not talk like that. He's not a haberdasher.
Oh, he's a Midwesterner. He has his R's.
I can't tell you how very much I appreciate the honor which you just conferred upon me, I shall continue to try to deserve it.
And what's interesting is that his speaking is not something anybody was particularly interested in paying attention to. He wasn't considered an orator. He wasn't a performer. But yes, he's somebody who did not have that kind of awelessness, and no one ever expected that he was going to become president anyway.
Let's now hear from one of Teddy Roosevelt's six children, and no one had more fun children than T.R. had in the White House. Okay, so let's hear from Ethel Roosevelt Derby.
The children especially will be interested in seeing that odd little animal under the table there. His name is Josiah, and my father, knowing how we liked to have things brought home to us whenever we could from his trips out west, used to bring us home treasures.
Wow.
One time he brought us a bear, which lived in the woodshed. This time he brought home a little badger. I took a picture of my brother Archie in his ordinary garb, barefoot, you know, with his little ragged trousers, holding Josiah, my father used to say, hissing like a tea kettle.
Boy, and you can see why people think this is about Great Britain. Archie, the badger. That was a wonderful clip.
It is so great. And I had to tell you, the picture of Archie holding Josiah the badger is just adorable.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to look this up.
Oh, you've got to look it up. You will, of course, not remember that I wrote a book about presidential pets in 2004. And so Teddy Roosevelt was my favorite chapter.
I didn't know this.
No, of course he didn't. So I've seen the sales figures. And he had 36 pets. And he,
really?
Oh, yeah. He had amazing pets. He had amazing pets.
Did the Lincolns have any pets?
They did. They had a horse named Old Bob. Mm-hmm. They had a dog, which is the very first photographed presidential pet.
Huh.
The dog's name was Fido. And it's actually a very sweet picture of Fido. He was a mutt, which is perfect for Lincoln. Yeah,
wow.
And then they had two goats named Nanny and Nanko.
Did the dog sit still in the Lincoln picture, or is it all blurry because...
No, the dog is actually seated on what looks like a pedestal, like a plinth.
That's the way they would do it. Yeah.
And after Lincoln died, a drunk with a knife stabbed the dog. Oh.
You're kidding.
I'm just bringing all of us really down. It's really, really terrible. But let me just make it better by saying that Teddy Roosevelt, they had a little bear that they named Jonathan Edwards. So next time we listen to Ethel Roosevelt, say, Jonathan Edwards, the bear.
And the bear.
And they had a hyena.
Did they really have a hyena?
They did have a hyena. Wow. No, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I hope those kids had all their shots. I want to give this guy some props. Cornelius Vanderbilt IV, because he was an outcast from the Vanderbilt family because he dared to get into newspapers. Can you imagine that? It's as if he'd gotten an OnlyFans account. He was working for a newspaper. My God. Okay. He produced what is arguably the very first anti-Hitler documentary, Hitler's Reign of Terror, in 1934. It met with a cold shoulder as hysteria. It warned people about anti-Semitism. So if just for that, let's listen to him.
There isn't money enough in Hollywood to tempt me to go through it again. I tell you, that last day on the frontier, I felt like Mickey Mouse. It was one tough squeak for me. I knew just what I would be up against if the Nazis ever found my films. The last few weeks, I'd been carefully watched.
He sounds like Betty Davis.
And Nazis.
Nazi, yeah. You hear that occasionally.
I never heard that.
In the 30s, the Nazis, yeah. Yeah, that's something that people, it was a spelling pronunciation. If you don't know German, and so it looks like Nazi, and some people would get away with saying it. That guy says is a piece of work.
Yeah, he really is.
Did he have a family?
He was married 7 or 8 times, never had children.
Damn.
It seemed like a guy, just for the documentary alone, we got to give the guy some props. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what it was like to be married to him, but I mean, I like him. I like him. Okay, let's hear another voice often associated with this accent. This is a conservative intellectual, founder of the National Review, and co-host of the TV show Firing Line, William F. Buckley.
If the telephone company projected the number of people using telephones in 1938, they figured that at the rate at which people were using the telephone, by 1960, in order to service that many calls, they'd have to hire every woman in the United States as a telephone operator.
Now, this is a much parodied accent. What is it that we're hearing there that we're reacting to?
He's speaking rather quickly, not a whole lot of melodic change, almost as if he can't be bothered to enunciate too much. there's a privilege in it, and that he sounds like he can't quite be bothered to try to get himself across. He assumes that you're listening in closely.
There's a certain lack of effort, or I'm not sure if it's a fatigue in there.
A detachment?
Detachment.
It might also be brilliance, because he was brilliant, whatever you think of the content of the things that he wrote and said. And so he's so committed to the thinking that he can't be bothered with performance, is one kind of quick psychology you might pull.
Buckley indeed had a cosmopolitan upbringing. Born in New York, he grew up speaking Spanish and received his early formal education in France and England. But it wasn't just those to the manor born who spoke this way. Let's turn back to entertainment to listen to a commercial from the early 1980s starring the Bronx's Betty Joan Persky, a.k.a. Lauren Bacall.
My favorite time of day is night. I love curling up with a rich cup of coffee. You think coffee and sleep don't mix? They do if it's High Point. It's decaffeinated, and the flavor's marvelous. You see, High Point has a special way of capturing flavor. Deep-brewed flavor. It's a coffee lover's dream.
Betty Joan Persky was born in the Bronx.
Okay.
Yeah. Grew up pretty hardscrabble. Now, we can only guess, because she started in Hollywood when she was so young. But do we think that an adolescent Betty Joan Persky, soon to be Lauren Bacall, was Arliss?
She definitely would have been Arliss, because this Arlessness was not only people of a certain means. It was also people who were middle and even lower class. Lauren Bacall had an air about her, especially as she got older. And so it ends up sounding rather high toned that she says flavor. But she learned to say flavor probably in the Bronx in a very hot third floor apartment, because that's the way everybody would have spoken there.
She's playing a high-status character in one of the High Point commercials. She's in a limousine drinking High Point coffee. She's actually pouring it, which is insane.
Well,
because how are you? I mean, these are New York City streets. There are potholes everywhere. Yeah. There's a major lawsuit ready to happen.
My pants are full of flavor.
Yeah. These pants are full of flavor. I'm the woman of the year with third-degree burns. Okay, sorry. Coming up after a break, how to speak with distinction when quoting from the classics.
Don't say flavor and hold
flavor.
It. Get
flavor.
Off it quicker. Flavor.
You see, High Point has a special way of capturing flavor.
Better. Yes.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
UC High Point.
UC High Point.
That's not bad. UC High Point has a special way of capturing flavor.
UC High Point has a special way of capturing flavor.
Cap, cap.
Cap.
Cha,
cha,
like C-H-A.
Got it.
Capturing.
Capturing. Dialect coach Jessica Drake is teaching me to pitch decaf like Lauren Bacall. Since the late 1980s, Jessica's been helping major Hollywood actors get into character for movies and TV. She helped Sean Penn play Harvey Milk and Ana de Armas become Marilyn Monroe. I'm curious, what are you asked most about?
It's Forrest Gump. It's always Forrest Gump. That's it.
The Alabama accent.
Yes.
Now, because I'd been a football star and a war hero and national celebrity and a shrimping boat captain and a college graduate, this City Falls of Greenbow, Alabama, decided to get together and offered me a fine job.
you know, for an actor, it's another piece, right? It's like a false nose or a limp. It's a thing that they add to the character. It's a piece that brings them closer to that other person they're playing.
The accent that we're talking about is commonly called the Mid-Atlantic accent, the Transatlantic accent. Is that a misnomer?
Yes, it is. First of all, Mid-Atlantic, I just want to say, would be Delaware, Maryland, something like that. The idea, the notion, is it's halfway between English and American speech. And so it's this mythological place that doesn't exist in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, my gosh. I know exactly right. The closest you could get is the southern tip of Greenland. And I don't think they talk like that there.
No, definitely not. Well observed. It's got nothing to do with that. It was a real accent. Loads of people spoke that way.
So what would you call this accent we're talking about?
I would call it probably Northeastern elite because it's associated with those regions. I mean, where you really would hear it is places like New York City, Newport, Rhode Island, Darien, Connecticut, Kennebunkport, Maine, and Boston.
Now, this way of speaking wasn't only about dropping R's. You'll also notice a softening and elongation of the vowels, especially the A sound.
Well, and can I say, my father, who grew up in a factory town called Leominster, Massachusetts, I would hear every so often, he would say bathroom instead of the bathroom. He'd say bathroom.
Bathroom.
The bathroom.
I need,
yeah.
Or bathroom. Yeah.
Yeah, that A. And I would go bathroom, but he'd go bathroom.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's pretty good, Mo. You have a pretty good middle A.
Jessica Drake says that for most people, this accent wasn't learned formally in school.
The influences on most people's speech are pretty basic. It's your parents and it's your friends when you're young. And that's pretty much where it gets formed. But were there classes? I think unless you were pursuing either a career in the arts or perhaps going to, say, some sort of a finishing school, which is a thing that existed then, yeah. But otherwise, no.
One piece of misinformation you'll find online about this accent is the notion that it was taught to Golden Age Hollywood actors by a woman named Edith Skinner, a speech teacher best known for writing a book called Speak with Distinction. Jessica Drake was one of Skinner's students at New York's famed Juilliard School, and she wants to set the record straight about her late mentor.
Edith Skinner was really dedicated to the theater more than anything else, the theater. She is responsible definitely for training a whole generation of regional theater actors.
But Jessica says Skinner couldn't have coached those old-timey Hollywood stars because she never once worked in Hollywood.
How did she become associated with this accent?
Misinformation. It's the simplest answer. Unfortunately, there have been things put into print that have claimed that she was in Hollywood teaching in the 30s or that actors were running around the studio lots carrying her book under their arms. This is all complete and total fabrication.
In fact, her book wasn't published until 1942, and then it was only available in the bookstore at Pittsburgh's Carnegie Tech, where she taught at the time. Now, Edith Skinner did teach a later generation of actors something that would come to be known as good American speech.
So the sound that she came up with, the good American speech, is certainly based on what we've been talking about, that Northeastern accent. However, it had specifically something she called the 7 points.
One of those 7 points Skinner prescribed was softening those R's, but not quite as much as old-time Hollywood actors often did. Skinner's method also encourages performers to pronounce certain words with a middle A.
What she called the ask list of words. Those are words that Southern English would pronounce with a long A. Ask, pass, clause. And she had it at ask, pass, class, which is not ask, pass, class, which would be more general American.
One of Skinner's students, the actor Ellis Rabb, here in a production of the comedy The Royal Family.
He said, "Who is directing this picture?" I said, "You're directing the picture. You're not directing me. I'm through with it. And you can take that to remember me by."
Ellis Rabb, taught by Edith Skinner, was the inspiration for Kelsey Grammer's voice for Sideshow Bob on The Simpsons, which means that Sideshow Bob was trained by Edith Skinner.
"Lisa, you always were the one rose petal floating atop the cesspool that is The Simpsons."
You see, you can tie Edith to these things that way. Kelsey was a student of hers at Juilliard as well. And I would say the Frasier sound is in no small part connected to that Edith training.
"It's hard to say what to hate most about Crane's show. His pompous, sanctimonious style, his constant self-congratulatory references to his own life, or his voice, a mock sympathetic tone, so sickly sweet, one wonders if the man graduated from medical school or from some mind-controlling cult."
And how's this for influence that's truly out of this world?
Robin Williams. He took some of the speech exercises and turned them into that language that Mork spoke. She has an exercise, ma, me, me, my, mo, mu, na, ne, ni, ni, no, nu, la, le, li, li, lo, lu.
Oh my God, that's where Nanu Nanu came from then. Out of that. Wow.
"We'll catch you on the rebound, your magnitude. Until next week, Nanu, Nanu."
Coming up, more with linguist John McWhorter.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
Is this a white accent?
This is, of course, largely associated with white people, but an interesting thing about the olden times is that there was a sense in the United States that if you were going to be a person of influence, you had to learn to talk in a certain way.
I'm back with linguist John McWhorter to finish talking about the way some of us used to talk.
And one of the most counterintuitive things, I think, these days, because of all sorts of layers of assumptions that we make, is that black public figures did the same thing. So Booker T. Washington was born a slave. He learned to sound like William Jennings Bryan because that is just what one had to do. And this included for black audiences as well. And so you listen to people, especially in the first half of the 20th century when you can have recordings of them, black leaders, and it can be jarring how, frankly, what to our ears is white they sound today. But really what it was public oratory, American style.
Let's hear the voice of educator and orator and founder of the National Negro Business League, Booker T. Washington. It may be a little hard to make out since it was recorded in 1908.
"Those of my race who depend on bettering their condition in a foreign land, or who underestimate the importance of cultivating friend relations, the southern white man who is their next door neighbor, I would say, cast down your bucket where you are. Pass it down, making friends in every manly way."
So Booker T. Washington, we can only speculate,
he would not have said, I'm trying to sound white. He would have said, I'm trying to sound like a public figure who's respected.
He would almost certainly have said that. Yeah, the idea that we would listen to him and think he sounded white, he would have to wrap his head around that. He would think, how else was I supposed to sound if I was standing up in front of a massive audience making a speech? And this would include a black audience. Booker T. Washington didn't try to sound white. He tried to sound formal.
Let's listen to who is often used as sort of the counterpoint to Booker T. Washington. This is the activist, pioneering sociologist, and socialist W.E.B. Du Bois, reading from his autobiography. So presumably this is much later in his life.
I went from my home in Massachusetts when I was 17 down to Fisk University in Tennessee. There I stayed 3 years. Then I came from there to Harvard University in the fall of 85 and stayed there 4 years.
You know why that's perfect? That's so perfect. Du Bois was R-ful. He had his R's. The reason he's R-ful is because there is this otherwise utterly boring difference. It's a dialectician's thing between Western and Eastern New England. Boston accent is Eastern. Western is, say, Great Barrington, where he grew up. I actually went to college for 2 years in Great Barrington.
In the Berkshires.
In the Berkshires. And that's why he says year instead of the year. And so he's on the other side of that line. Isn't that neat?
Well, it's such an interesting clip to me because first he goes Massachusetts, but he keeps his R in Harvard. And there are moments, and I could be getting this wrong, where it almost sounds like a burr. He almost sounds Scottish.
He also just sounds like he's very much from another time. His vowels are something that we wouldn't hear in anybody in the United States these days. Because if you're listening to Du Bois, you're listening to somebody who learned to talk at the end of the 1800s. And yet he lived long enough to be recorded in good sound in that way.
And I think a whole heck of a lot of people who know who W.E.B. Du Bois was and who have read him would be shocked to listen to that.
Oh, you know, to tell you the truth, and this is getting into a less cuddly dimension of these things, but as a black person, I have often thought this. Many people who are big fans of people like Du Bois today might find themselves involuntarily put off by the way he spoke, because he had, there's no hint of what we today think of as blackness in the voice of that man. And it isn't an affectation. But there's all evidence that that's the way he and people like him always spoke. And I think many black people today, quite innocently, would be waiting for him to kind of get down and use certain expressions and to, you know, have some R-lessness and to have some vowel colorations. And he would never do it. And I think it would make a lot of them rather uncomfortable. Whenever I've heard Du Bois, I think to myself, socially, it'd be a little awkward now for many black leaders, even black intellectuals and black thinkers. We have a whole different sense of what makes a person approachable and perhaps even our value of what approachability is.
Very interesting. Well, so we talked about William F. Buckley earlier, one of his famous debate partners, James Baldwin. So let's listen to James Baldwin.
The reason for the political hesitation and in spite of the Johnson landslide is the one that's been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know, and neither does Martin Luther King, none of us know, how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say. And one can't blame them. You watch what has happened to them in less than 20 years.
I mean, James Baldwin's voice is beautiful.
It
sounds pretty close to British to my untrained ears.
He was a performer. I'm a huge admirer of Baldwin, but he was cultivating a persona. But to be honest, I just hear black and 1920s New York. If anything, to me, he sounds like Eartha Kitt. And Eartha Kitt was not trying to sound British. She was trying to sound like Eartha Kitt.
I want to be evil. That's my favorite Eartha Kitt.
She's amazing.
I want to be mean. One interesting point here, and tell me if you think this factored in, James Baldwin's stepfather was a preacher. I wonder if that had any bearing.
You know, it probably did, because Baldwin had a very close relationship to the preaching and the church and the performance aspect of that. That definitely would have affected him. What you're not supposed to say, though, and I'm going to say it because I think many people are thinking it, is that another thing he was doing, I think, was imitating the way many gay men of that time spoke. I think that there's some amount of playing with that dynamic, too. So there's the preaching, there's the performing, there is his sexuality, there is his blackness. You could pour all of those things and mix them up and almost predict that what would come out is him saying Martin in the way that he does.
We spent so much time focusing on the eastern part of the United States. Let's hear a clip from a great playwright from Chicago, Lorraine Hansberry.
In other words, what I was trying to say is exactly the opposite of what you paid attention to. That is that we are not concerned, or perhaps I'd better say I am not concerned, with doing away with the mere paraphernalia, traditional paraphernalia of the inexpressive, crude Negro character. That is not the point. I very arbitrarily, very deliberately, of thought and intention, chose to write, for instance, and I come from the Negro middle class, about the Negro working class. Deliberately so.
I love the way she talks.
There's something about the way she spoke. And what's interesting is that she has a few ums in there. She's almost certainly smoking, chain smoker. And so there's some false starts as she kind of composes her thoughts while taking puffs on the cigarette. And yet I must admit, as a modern linguist, I spend a lot of time arguing that there are no grounds for looking down on new speech habits. And I very much mean it. But I must admit, I'm going to only say this once on this show, and I'm never going to say it again. I must admit, I liked that she wasn't saying like and sort of every 2 seconds, because her equivalent today, including she could be just as fierce, just as educated, just as talented, it would be sort of every 4 sentences or so. That's not as good as what we just heard. And it's because she lived in a time when public eloquence was still valued in a way that it just isn't today. You don't grow up living under the strictures that she did in terms of how you were expected to speak in public. And she didn't sound like George Washington's inaugural address, but that was different from all of the humble hesitations that are part of the way most modern people express themselves. I must admit, I'd rather hear that.
Her father was a successful real estate broker. Her mother was a ward committee woman in municipal politics. Mm-hmm. So they weren't rich, but there's something, and she describes herself as a member of the Negro middle class.
Negro middle class. And not the, and she wrote about the Negro working class. But she went to school beside, you know, many white people, and she lived in an environment where there was a sense that if you were going to present yourself in public, you had to speak in a certain way. And I am quite sure that she did not think of herself as speaking whitely. She thought of herself as speaking the way one was supposed to in order to go out into the world and try to make a difference.
You know, I have to say, of all the clips we've heard, this is the one that if I heard today, I would say, I really like hearing this person talk. This doesn't seem like a put on. This doesn't seem alien to me. It's like she's speaking in a way that's almost a bridge between that accent we've been talking about and today.
Mm-hmm. Because she is somebody who's in her late 20s in that clip, I think. And she's speaking in, is that 1960?
It is 1961.
Okay, yeah. And so she has learned to speak in the middle of the previous century. So she's not going to sound as arch as, say, black female activist Mary McLeod Bethune, where if you listen to her making speeches, she sounds like Eleanor Roosevelt. But she also, Lorraine Hansberry, is not a modern person yet. And so she speaks with a certain crisp directness. You sense that she knows there's a microphone in front of her and she's therefore supposed to switch into a certain mode.
And she treats her vowels right. She really does. And, but she's also from the Midwest, and we love the Midwest.
And therefore, there's none of the weird R-lessness. Right. She's got her proper R's. Yeah. Yeah, that is, that's, let's make her the voice of the 20th century. That's the best voice of the 20th century.
I really love that clip.
So what happened to the accent? The last time I heard it in a movie was probably 2004 in The Aviator, when Cate Blanchett played Katharine Hepburn.
It's all been a grand adventure, but it couldn't possibly last. We're too alike, you and I.
The truth is, some Golden Age actors had never adopted it. Through the 30s and 40s, manly man actors like Gary Cooper and Clark Gable brazenly brandished their R's.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
But then the accent started disappearing.
There certainly seemed to come a time after World War II, and no one knows exactly why, when that accent was no longer fashionable.
The war itself was probably a factor, with infantrymen from all over the country mixing, accents and dialects blending together. And then, 6 years after the war ended, a film performance that dealt a blow to the accent. Here's Jessica Drake again.
Marlon Brando in Streetcar Named Desire changed a lot of people's ideas about what had to happen, certainly in movies and entertainment and in the theater in terms of speech.
You know what I say? Ha-ha! You hear me? Ha-ha-ha!
But I also think that the culture began to shift because the television came about. Now we had sources from all over the country, but a lot coming from the West, which in many ways, to this day, I would say, has gone a long way to kind of leveling a lot of regionalisms too. Not just the Northeastern elite sound, but all accents.
The year after Brando in Streetcar, the movie musical Singin' in the Rain, with a hilarious scene between the ridiculously untalented actress, played by the wonderful Gene Hagen, being tutored by an equally ridiculous diction coach, played by Kathleen Freeman.
Now let me hear you read your line.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
Can't.
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 Yeah. You know, that's a good timeline piece, because there that is, it's 1952, and they're making fun of the idea that there's a certain plummy way that people need to learn how to talk. Mm-hmm. And that's a sign of the times. That character wouldn't have been as funny in 1942.
And then 30 years later, the knockout punch against the accent. A 1982 performance by Hollywood heavyweight Meryl Streep.
I don't care that I would die. I am afraid that he would die without me.
What is the significance of Sophie's Choice?
I think it made a huge impact because Meryl Streep's Polish accent is flawless and real. And it does so much to amplify the emotional life of that character and the truth of that story.
So I hid that ham under my skirt on the train. I'm pretending that I am pregnant, you know. Oh, I was so afraid. I was shaking.
And I think after that, suddenly it became very important to get the accents right. And everyone's trying to be real now and not a fantasy or better than us in the old days of the Golden Age and Louis B. Mayer. It's not that at all. It's now let's really get down in it.
And do you miss what I guess we'll just call this old-timey accent?
You know something, Mo? I don't miss it. And the reason is because, one, with home video and streaming such as it is, so much of it is at our fingertips that we can have it whenever we want it. And two, I enjoy listening to the variety of normal modern voices. To me, it's all just a menagerie of different vowels and consonants and melodies and slang and new ways of using words. So, no, I don't miss it, but I think it's very charming.
As for me, I kind of do miss it. And you never know, it could come back, and I'll be ready.
It's a coffee lover's dream.
That's your best line. Excellent.
I hope you enjoyed this Mobituary. May I ask you to please rate and review our podcast? You can also follow Mobituaries on Facebook and Instagram. And you can follow me on the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, @Moraka. Hear all new episodes of Mobituaries every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Mobituaries' Great Lives Worth Reliving, the New York Times best-selling book, available in paperback and audiobook. This episode of Mobituaries was produced by Aaron Schrank. Our team of producers also includes Hazel Bryan and me, Mo Rocca, with engineering by Josh Hahn. Our theme music is written by Daniel Hart. Our archival producer is Jamie Benson. Mobituaries' production company is Neon Hum Media. Indispensable support from Alan Pang, Annie Cronenberg, and everyone at CBS News Radio. Special thanks to Tim Monick, Diane Camp, Steve Razies, Rand Morrison, and Alberto Robina. Executive producers for Mobituaries include Megan Marcus, Jonathan Hirsch, and Mo Rocca. The series is created by yours truly.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.